The 10 seconds it took Corwin Ravenhair to reach the ground from the Otori Academy Student Council's balcony on the bell tower were the longest 10 seconds of his life. As he fell, his Mycian hunter's cloak flapping gaily around him, he saw the magnificent multicolored creation that was the combined trio of rune gods lunge forward, bringing its great and terrible sword to bear on the towering machine that contained Princess Emerald, the Pillar of Sephira. It all seemed to happen in slow motion. He could see every movement, every little working of every interconnected part of the impossibly elegant mechanism that was the combined rune god, all its breathtaking complexity, and its terrible, implacable purpose. "Do they know," he wondered, "that that's Princess Emerald in there? Have they realized yet what they're really here to do?" He was too far away, his voice too small to make any difference, his influence on the situation precisely nil. He'd gone over the railing because it was the fastest way down, but he wasn't halfway to the ground when the blow struck home. The light scrape of his boots on the cracked white stones of the paved academy quadrangle was drowned by the titanic crash of Emerald's shattered war machine collapsing on its back. And with that sound, time seemed to snap back to its normal consistency, like a released elastic band. From above, surrounded by a faltering bubble of green-gold light, an impossibly small, delicate form in scarlet-stained white robes settled to the ground. As Corwin walked across the quad, watching through tear-blurred eyes as the rune gods separated and their pilots appeared in showers of golden sparks, he remarked to himself that it was lucky his guess about levitation accompanying gate manifestation was correct. He'd have felt pretty stupid about plummeting to his death in the middle of all that. "I have a message from another time." Avery Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword No. 2, 6th Movement, Knights of the Tenth World, Part 3, Endgame, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Anne Cross. Slowly, dreadfully, Corwin walked past the smoking wreckage of Emerald's war machine, his heart sinking within him. The rune gods stood in a semicircle, silent and still, with their knights in a cluster around a fallen form. Fu and Hikaru were kneeling, one on each side, while Umi stood back, tears running down her cheeks as she cried silently. Nal, looking wilted and sad, came down from the sky in his cat form and alighted on Umi's shoulder. "You can't die?" Hikaru was sobbing as Corwin approached. She clutched at the fallen woman's hand while Fu glittered with emerald magic, trying desperately to put her back together.
"Please don't die. We were supposed to save you."
Corwin knelt next to Hikaru and met those bottomless green eyes, putting an arm around the Seleucian girl's shoulders.
"Don't cry for me,"
Emerald whispered to Hikaru.
"You were never meant to save me. You were here to save Sephiro." "But you're Sephiro," Hikaru sobbed. "Only for a little longer,"
Emerald rasped.
"Storm Knight, save your strength, but please,"
she added in a softer tone as she saw the tears glittering in Fu's eyes.
"Help me to sit up."
Fu and Umi helped the wrecked woman into a sitting position. Emerald's blonde hair fell behind her, still shining gloriously, despite the ruin of the rest of her.
"Listen to me," she gasped. "The Rune Knights are the last salvation of any pillar. Nothing..."
She turned her head aside and coughed, then continued in a more normal voice.
"Nothing in Sephiro may harm the pillar, not even the pillar herself. But When Akio Otori killed my priest, the man I loved above all else in the world, I lost hope. Sagato and I, we were never really able to be together, not as we wanted. I was pillar, and he was priest. But with him gone...
She coughed again. Hikaru's sobbing had taken her beyond words as she stared at the pillar's face. Fu's mouth was a thin, tight line as she struggled not to let her pain interfere with the strength she was giving the pillar. Umi and Nal were perfectly still, like a single entity cast in stone, listening with all of their beings.
"There was nothing left for me,"
Emerald whispered.
"I prayed to die, and so you came. You have saved me. You have ended my life alone, and wherever I go now, I know Sagato and I will somehow be together."
She reached a trembling hand out.
"Please," she begged softly, "do not grieve for me. You have saved me."
And then, more strongly,
"But you have not yet saved Sephiro."
Corwin's eyes burned into her face, and she turned her head slightly to look at him.
"I was deceived. We have all been deceived. And our deceiver stands poised to seize ultimate power with my passing. Someone must stop him."
Her green eyes widened in desperation and pain. She lunged forward suddenly, clutching at his shoulder with her free hand, leaving bloody tracks on his hunter's cloak, and repeated,
"Someone must stop him!"
Corwin nodded. "Someone will," he replied. Emerald smiled at that.
"You have a strong heart," she told him. "You remind me of someone I once knew. May I know your name?"
"Corwin," he said, bowing his head. "Corwin Ravenhair, of Avalon and Asgard, son of Skuld the Tomorrow Maker, and of Griffin the Midgard Knight." Emerald's eyes flickered with recognition.
"Asgard," she whispered. "Then perhaps there is still hope. Will you become a rune knight? Will you be my champion, visitor from the Golden City? Will you avenge my love and me? Will you save my world from my folly?"
Corwin looked into her eyes for a long moment, then bowed his head again in a nod. "I will," he told her. Smiling at his words, Emerald reached up and removed the namesake gemstone she wore at her throat, snapping the chain that held it there. With her other hand, still held in Corwin's, she raised his hand. Then she tucked the gem into it, folding his fingers around it. It was still warm from its contact with her, one side sticky with her blood. The sensation was enough to make him want to cry.
"I regret that it cannot be more,"
said Emerald, her voice fainter still.
"I pray it will be enough. Go to the arena in the sky, Rune Knight. Go and save my sister. Go and save my world."
"Your sister," Corwin murmured, looking startled. Then, as he regarded the lines of her face, he understood and nodded gravely. "I'll do all I can for her," he said. Emerald smiled a final time, drew his hand to her lips, and kissed it.
"Spirits of success ride with you," she whispered. "Goodbye, Corwin of Asgard."
Corwin knelt looking at her for a moment longer. Then he nodded, slipped his hand from hers, bent to kiss her cheek, and straightened, turning away toward the stairs to the secret forest. Corwin?" said Hikaru, taking a step toward him. Then she paused and turned her agonized eyes back to Emerald.
"Rune Knights,"
Emerald whispered,
"do not grieve. I was brought to this by treachery, but it remains my wish. Now that I have a champion, I can join my beloved Zagato with a peaceful heart. Support him in this, and whatever debt you feel you owe me will be discharged."
"Your Highness, I..."
Hikaru began, but the princess's beautiful green eyes slipped shut, and Princess Emerald, Pillar of Sephiro, died. Fu Hōji sniffed back a sob and turned to Corwin's back as he stood looking at the last guardian golem, the immense scarlet-armored creature that stood between them and the gates to the secret forest.
"Mr. Corwin," she asked, "what will you do?"
"Your rune gods are exhausted," Corwin said, his tone somewhere between desperate and thoughtful. "And so is Nahl."
"That's true, but..." said Nahl.
"So I guess I'll have to handle this guy on my own," Corwin went on.
"We can..."
Umi said, but Corwin had frozen, staring off into space with a startled expression. A voice filled the rune knight's ears, booming, cold, and hard. The knights staggered, clapping their hands to their ears, except for Corwin, who stood as if turned to stone, looking up into the sky with a look of sudden comprehension.
"Iron Knight," it said. "Sword forger, engine maker, long have I waited for you."
"Yes,"
Corwin whispered.
"Your coming was heralded. Your heart is worthy. Take your place among the Rune Knights."
Corwin nodded. "Yes," he repeated, louder this time.
"Name me," the voice demanded. "Give me form. Give me meaning. Give me purpose."
Corwin slowly raised his hand, looking at the gem Emerald had given him. With the death of its previous owner, it had gone dull and dark, acquiring a sudden cold that made his hand ache. He clenched it in his fist until the edges bit into his fingers, raised it to his chest, and began to chant in his mother's tongue.
"I am earth. I am a strong foundation. I am a ruinous upheaval. I am the tools of all creation. I am the weapons of all destruction. I am all these things and more. I am the Rune Knight of Iron."
Corwin raised the gem above his head. Blood trickled down where its edges had bitten into his fingers, and suddenly it flared with light. No longer green, but a brilliant blood red. As the scarlet light engulfed him, his battered traveler's clothing disintegrated, replaced by a rune knight's ceremonial armor. Black trousers, sturdy black boots with a row of silver buckles up the side, a black tunic with a high collar. Greaves, vambraces, and a breastplate of black steel, covered with delicate silver lines like the traces of circuitry. Over that, a rich night-black cloak with silver edgings and the inside laid with that same circuit-like tracery. Drawing a deep breath, he cried out in a louder voice,
"I am Corwin of the Raven Hair, son of She Who Builds Tomorrow, son of the Knight of Midgard, chooser of the slain, cavalier of three worlds, rune knight of iron. By my will and by my power, birthright from my divine mother, this is my command."
Corwin's brand glowed with a high, keening noise, and a fresh column of light, this not scarlet but white, surrounded him. His cloak and hair ruffled upward as though a wind were blowing up from beneath him.
The rune knights drew back in surprise. The presence fluttered into him, blotting out his perception of anything but its great might and aching need, its formless power trapped in dreamless sleep since the formation of the 10th world. Closing his eyes, he did as his mother had taught him, concentrating hard on the final form, on the angles and planes of armor, the workings of weapons, the colossal complexity of an engine of war. It was the greatest working he had ever attempted, orders of magnitude beyond anything he had ever made before. Everything else in the universe was blotted out of his mind by the myriad of details, of systems and specifications that fluttered across his mind's eye as he bent the power to his will. "Nameless God of Iron, hear the command of the Son of Innovation! Rise from your endless slumber, and let ye at last be born! Let the lightning sear your legend across the heavens, as I cry out your name, Orihalcon!" As his voice gave wing to the last word, the lightning did indeed speak, screaming down from the stormy heavens to strike the gem he held aloft. In the same instant, the earth beneath Corwin's feet heaved and split with a duplicate crash, the deep, explosive crack of sundered bedrock. The bolt blended with the glow surrounding the young god to obliterate the rune knight's vision in a blinding blue-white flash that sent them reeling back, shielding their eyes and crying out in pain. When their vision cleared, they gasped as one, standing and gaping in awe. Where, a moment before, Corwin had stood alone, now towered a great black machine in the shape of a man. In size and sense, it was reminiscent of their rune gods, but in a completely different style, its armor studded with rivets and plate lines, and chased with gold and copper-orange accents. On its broad chest was a great golden medallion. Its lower arms were enormous, powerful-looking, with great spiked knuckles on immense hands. Its head, crowned with a gleaming coppery helmet, had a human face set in a permanent glower. A doorway stood open in its upper chest, on the slope just above the gold medallion, and standing in it was Corwin Ravenhair, the blood lens gleaming now on his left wrist. He didn't look like a man who had just been struck by lightning, though smoke was curling up gently from the brand on his forehead. "Now then," said Corwin. He surveyed the massive form of the guardian golem, 100 yards or so distant, now beginning to show an interest in the new addition to the battlefield. "You guys had better get to cover. Nall, you stay with them," he cried. And the rune knights gathered up Emerald's body and retired from the field. Corwin turned and went through the doorway into the massive machine's interior, and it closed behind him with a solid metallic sound. The cockpit was large, round, and high-ceilinged, paneled with video displays and full of a dull reddish illumination. There was a chair in the center, surrounded by banks of switches, dials, knobs, and secondary displays. Corwin took off his satchel, put it down on the floor, then seated himself in the control chair and placed his feet on the pedals. A control ring dropped down around him and delivered a pair of joysticks to his hands. He smiled. This was a control system he'd thought of years ago, but never had the chance to implement. Now he was going to see how it worked. With a mechanical clunk, the whole cockpit lowered on a platform, descending deeper into the machine's chest, before coming to rest just behind the golden medallion. Just in front of Corwin's feet, a circular display panel raised itself into his field of view and lit up. A message marched across it in large white letters. "Cast in the name of God. You're not guilty." All around him, the main displays rezzed up, giving him a 360-degree view of the world around the rune god which he had named Orihalcon. Corwin's smile got a little wider. Nice touch by his subconscious mind, putting the traditional Valkyrie sword tag in there like that. He'd have to thank himself later. if he survived. He gripped the joysticks, took a deep breath, and then cried, "Now, Big O, it's showtime!" Big O's eyes pulsed. He drew himself up, then began to walk forward with an inexorable stride that befit his massive stature, powerful arms swinging with each step, impressing deep footprints into the soft earth. The golem hunched its angular body, then lunged. It was very fast. Its weird, spindly shape gave it a certain feral grace that was at odds with Big O's stately progress. Snarling beneath its mask, the scarlet creature flung itself upon the black-armored rune god, produced a wicked-looking dagger from one of the stubby wings on its shoulders, and slashed at the golden medallion on Big O's chest which concealed the pilot's station. Corwin snarled, yanked one of the joysticks back on its curved track, and then rammed it forward with all his strength. Obediently, Big O reared back his right arm, then drove his spiked fist into the golem's midsection. Scarlet armor cracked. The monster's four green eyes glowed brighter as it threw itself back and regrouped, hunching into a knife fighter's crouch. "It doesn't seem to have any ranged weapons," Corwin mused. He'd always had the habit of talking aloud to himself when piloting Mecha. Or perhaps he was talking to the Mecha. He'd never really analyzed himself deeply enough to figure that out. He scanned the panel on his left side, then reached up and flipped a couple of toggle switches, causing lights to come on above them. "Let's see what this does," he said, and drove Big O forward. The golem was waiting for him this time. It feinted left, then lunged in from the right, its blade seeking one of the slots in Big O's chest medallion. Corwin didn't think that was actually a vulnerable spot, but he didn't particularly care to find out. This wasn't the time to be testing Big O's capabilities. He hadn't time to play games. Instead, he slipped the strike, noting with pleasure that the rune god moved much more smoothly than its bulk suggested, grabbed the golem's wrist with Big O's right hand, and seized its head in his left. He could probably have crushed its head outright in Big O's powerful fist, but that would have taken time, and time was something Corwin was short on. So instead, he flicked the safety cover off a thumb trigger atop the left joystick, pressed it down, and held it. A green light appeared on the instrument panel in front of him. Outside, the silver cylindrical ram in Big O's left elbow slammed back and held there. "So long," Corwin said. Then he released the trigger. The ram slammed forward again, and from the cuff around Big O's wrist came a blast of compressed air so powerful that it blew the guardian golem's head to a fine pink mist. The body twitched again, and then keeled over backward as Big O released its arm. Corwin turned the rune god of iron to face the gates of the secret forest. He considered knocking them down with one of the weapons at the big machine's disposal, but decided against it. It might do additional damage to whatever lay beyond that wall, and he couldn't afford to risk that. He'd just have to get it open the old-fashioned way. He shut Big O down, raised the cockpit, popped the hatch, and stood on the edge of the sloped armor of the rune god's breastplate for a moment, looking out at the white-walled, dark and gloomy forest. Then he went back, shrugged the strap of his satchel over his shoulder, crossed once more to the hatchway, and jumped down in two stages, one to the rune god's hand, the next to the ground. Stick reappeared in his hand with a crackle, and as the rune knights and Nall rejoined him, he led the way up the stairs to the edge of the Forest of Secrets. There, he found his way barred by a white stone door set into the wall that ringed the forest. There was a massive carved handle jutting from this door, backed by what looked like a mirror. Remembering what he'd been told of the place, Corwin looked down at his Institute Duelist's ring. It was only a copy of the ones worn by the Otori Academy Duelists, but perhaps it would suffice. Gripping the handle of the door with his left hand, he gave it an experimental tug. Nothing happened. He tugged a little harder. Still nothing. Damn it, he muttered. I may have to risk blowing the thing after all. He sighed in frustration and thumped his forehead against the stone. And, having done so, noticed something gleaming next to his toe. Hello, he murmured. What's this? Crouching, he picked it up and looked at it. It was another rose seal, identical in appearance to the one he already wore. But his magical sensitivity was so heightened by his recent experiences that the difference showed as plainly as if it had been pointed out by neon signs. This was a real duelist's ring, and a well-traveled one at that. In fact, just on an instinctive level, Corwin felt fairly certain he knew exactly whose it was, though how it had come to be here he couldn't have said. He raised his left hand, took off his Institute duelist's ring, pocketed it, and slipped the newfound ring onto his ring finger in its place. Somehow he wasn't surprised that it fit perfectly. Then, squaring himself, he seized the door's handle again. For a moment nothing happened. Then he felt a cold touch against his hand. Startled, he jerked it back and looked at it. A bead of chill water slid from the face of the rose ring he'd found and plopped audibly to the floor in the silent vault. Somewhere beneath the floor, something large and metallic-sounding shifted with a heavy clunk. And abruptly, water began gushing from the ducts along the sides of the room, pouring into the troughs on either side of the flagstone pathway, curtaining the walls and filling the room with mist. Behind the obscuring mist came other sounds, the grinding of great gears, the scrape of stone against stone. When the water stopped pouring and the mist receded, the wall before them had changed to an open doorway surmounted by a great stone rose. "Decor around here's a bit repetitive," Corwin murmured, then turned to the rune knights, his face serious. "Okay, kids," he said. "If what I suspect is true, this, believe it or not, is going to be the hard part. You've already done what you were summoned here to do. This next part is my business. Anybody wants to stay down here and sit it out?" He cracked a little grin. "I wouldn't blame him one bit." "Like hell," snarled Nall. "I may not have much strength left, but I'm not going to miss this." Hikaru nodded firmly. "Whoever is up there used us to murder the princess. I can't forgive that. I'll never give up until whoever did this faces justice." "You helped us in our quest, Mr. Corwin, even if that quest turned out to be a cruel sham," said Fu. "We could hardly abandon you now that the time has come for us to repay that debt." "That's right," declared Umi. "And Hikaru's right, too, Triforce help us. Whoever did this to us has got to pay." Corwin grinned at them, then said, "Well then, come on," and went through the portal. The magic knights followed. Hikaru, trotting, caught him up and passed him, then stopped and stood staring in awe at the structure before her. It was a stupendous spiral staircase, perhaps 20 feet wide, curling upward in a huge white stone helix and vanishing into the peculiar darkness of the secret forest's sky.
"Night Tat," Umi breathed. "What is it?"
"Don't be cruel," murmured Fu Hooji reverently.
"Where do these stairs go?" Hikaru asked Corwin.
"They go up," Corwin replied grimly. Then he walked around behind them, smiled a tight, controlled little smile, and pressed a button. "But we don't have to climb them," he said as a completely incongruous ding rang out. The sounds of the dreadful combat below had faded away halfway up the stairs, and now there was only silence, save for the sounds of their footfalls,
as Akio and his party arrived at the dueling platform. Anthy's heart, already heavy, sank as she saw this place again, and not only because of the bad memories. Strange as it seemed, she had fond memories of this place, too. Utrina's later duels, mainly, when the two of them had come to work as a team, the witch and her champion fighting together to rewrite their future. And now it was looking more and more like it had all come to nothing. "Nothing to say, Anthy?" Akio inquired with a sardonic smile. "This is about where you ought to tell me. I won't get away with it." "You seem to know that well enough already," Anthy replied, her voice calmer than her heart. "Why should I remind you?" Akio's eyes narrowed slightly. "I'll enjoy your company more," he said coldly, "when the circle has reminded you of your manners." As the five of them reached the far side of the platform, where a second, newly manifested arch led to a second staircase going further up, there came a loud crash behind them. As one, all five whirled, three startled, one mildly apprehensive, and one with her heart leaping in hope, for all knew that sound. It was the elevator, the one which had refused to work for Akio. The leap of Anthy's heart was short-lived, however, for though there were four people standing amid the cloud of rose petals on the center of the platform, none of them was Utrina. Three of them were the rune knights who had unwittingly killed Emerod. The fourth was a young man with coal-black hair, black and silver armor, a war staff, and a cold, angry expression. Anthy had never seen him before, and yet she couldn't shake the feeling that he was somehow familiar. The rune knights looked around them in amazement at the place Corwin had brought them to. It was a platform of stone, circular, perhaps 100 feet across. Its edge was rimmed with crenellations like an ancient castle, and its white stone floor inlaid with arcs of red to describe the face of a giant rose. To their left was a catwalk leading off into the sky from the edge of the platform. It ended at what appeared to be a stone doorway, sealed up with a great slab of white stone carved in a rose and bound by thorny vines. Behind them was an archway, the top of the stairway they'd seen at the bottom. Opposite it was another similar arch. Beyond it, another staircase, this one straight, rose perhaps 30 feet, doubled back on itself at a landing, and led to another, smaller platform positioned above the one they were on now. Suspended directly above the platforms was a glittering palace, its many towers and minarets pointing downward toward them. Hikaru gasped in wonderment. Umi gaped. Fu made the sign of the king. Corwin merely looked up at it, his face grim. He raised his left hand, made a sign with it, and the hanging castle's lights pulsed along with the brand on his forehead. With the look of a man whose darkest suspicion has been confirmed, he nodded thoughtfully, something ugly dancing in his clear blue eyes. "This platform isn't in Sephiro," he murmured. "What?" Umi blurted.
"Then where?"
"This is the border zone between the 10th world and Svartalfheim, the lowest of the celestial realms." He chuckled bitterly. "Heaven's basement, you might say. Those towers are carved from the roots of Yggdrasil," he added.
"Yggdrasil," Fu murmured. "The mighty kahuna tree."
Corwin gave her a cockeyed glance, then smiled tightly and said,
"Yep. The world engine is named for it. It was the first tree in the world. It grows in Odin's garden, in the courtyard of his palace, and its roots touch the five worlds of heaven. The myths say that Ouroboros gnaws upon them, but it seems to me that something worse has taken up residence these days." Another dark, humorless chuckle.
How's that for a clear and present danger to creation, Uncle Frey? So saying, he directed his flinty gaze down from the castle to the platform itself. 50 feet away, near the archway leading up, another group of 5 people stood regarding the rune knights. Hikaru, Umi, and Fu, startled, formed up around Corwin in a defensive knot. But Corwin stepped around Hikaru and faced the others squarely, letting Styx's ferrule clap ringingly onto the stone. "Which one of you?" he demanded in a voice tight with anger, omitting the phrase, "filth-swilling motherfuckers," only out of deference to the knight's tender years, "is Akio Otori." The one standing in the center, a dark-skinned, silver-haired, young-looking man possessed of a rather startling, slightly effeminate beauty, looked vaguely interested and took a step forward. "I am Akio Otori," he said calmly. "Who are you, and how do you know my name?" Corwin directed his eyes to Akio's right. A slender girl, a head shorter than he, with violet hair bundled up into a tight halo and the same milk-chocolate skin, stood there in a scarlet gown, her startled green eyes directed at Corwin behind thick spectacles. As his gaze passed over her, those green eyes locked on his, and a shock arrowed through his heart. For a moment, Corwin had the strangest feeling, as though they were alone on the platform, as though they were the only 2 people in the world. He knew her face, had seen her picture. She could only be Antihimemia, the Rose Bride. But more than that, he felt as if he knew her, had always known her. Like there was nothing he could hide from her, nothing he would want to hide from her, nothing in his heart that wasn't as plain to her as a printed page. And she blinked at him in surprise, and the moment was gone. He shook his head slightly, shaking off the weird disorientation. Oddly, though she couldn't ever have seen him before, what looked like a spark of recognition crossed her eyes. She raised a fist to her mouth, disbelief on her face. "I repeat," said Akio in the tone of a man whose patience is being tried, "how do you know my name?" Corwin transferred Styx to his right hand, tossed his cloak back out of his way with his left, and said calmly, "My name is Corwin Ravenhair. I have a message from Utena Tanjo." Antihimemia reacted with visible shock to that name, her green eyes flying wide as she gave a bright, silvery gasp. Akio's eyes, almost the same but for their air of cold arrogance, flickered with surprise. He started to move, reaching for the sword that hung at his belt, but Corwin moved faster. His left hand flicked to his belt and came up gripping a different kind of steel. Lockwork tripped. Hammer fell. Pin drove against primer. There was a sharp, snapping crack, and a puff of gray smoke that momentarily obscured the party at the center of the platform from the rune knight's view. Then the wind blowing across the platform cleared it, and Corwin made a little frustrated sound. Akio Otori was still standing there, a bloody graze across his cheek, the only evidence of Corwin's last bullet. Akio raised a fingertip to his cheek, traced the wound, and looked at the blood on his fingertip. Then, with an air of careless contempt, he wiped his finger across his sister's lips, and returned his hand to the grip of his sword. "You're a rune knight," he said, conversational, "and those must be the others. Well, it was nice of you to come, but you've already fulfilled the task that was set for you, so why don't you go away? I'm much too busy to deal with you." Corwin mastered his disappointment, dropped the bolt on his empty weapon, holstered it, and pointed to Anthe. "I want her." "Well," said Akio, "you can't have her." Corwin shifted Styx to a two-handed ready grip and narrowed his eyes. "We'll see about that." Akio shook his head as if disappointed. "This is boring me already," he declared. "Toga, Shiori, Nanami, kill them." The three others flanking Akio and his sister stepped forward, smiling. One, the man, had long scarlet hair and wore the white uniform of the Otori Academy Student Council. The second was a girl with raspberry maroon hair and a black jacketed version of the same uniform. The third, a younger, blonde girl, had on a uniform of vivid orange gold. The man had a katana, the elder girl a broadsword, the blonde a heavy-looking scimitar in one hand, and a wickedly curved jambia in the other. Closing ranks, the three blocked Corwin's path to their master, who was squiring Anthe toward the far staircase with a courtliness that was rather nauseating, given the way he'd just treated her a moment ago. Corwin snarled. "I don't have time for this," he muttered, squaring himself for battle. "What are you standing around for, Corwin?" Hikaru demanded, stepping around him. "Go after him!" "We'll take care of these losers," Umi added, advancing as well. "Yes, please hurry, Mr. Corwin," Fu urged him. "I don't know what Mr. Otori is up to, but given his demeanor, I doubt it bodes well for anyone but him."
I'll stay here for moral support," said Nall, digging his claws more firmly into Umi's pauldron.
Corwin glanced quickly around at each of them, his grim countenance lightening slightly. "You guys are the best," he said, and then threw himself into a dead run. The three Otori duelists set themselves to meet him, but before they could do so, two of the knights had already outpaced him.
"Heart of the Sea!" cried Umi.
As she dove past Corwin's left toward the red-headed duelist, her saber flowed out from her lens, taking solid form a split second before crashing against her opponent's katana. Staggered, he stumbled out of the defensive line and regrouped himself to deal with her instead.
"Heart of the Storm!"
Fu declared, and her greatsword swept into being as she leaped past Corwin's right. The raspberry-haired young woman spotted her coming just in time, aborting a cut at Corwin as he passed to defend herself from Fu instead. That left the blonde girl, who curled her lip in a sneer as she prepared to intercept Corwin.
"No, you don't!"
yelled Hikaru. Matching her pace to Corwin's, she suddenly put on a burst of speed, coiled her deceptively powerful little frame, and leaped straight over him, somersaulting once in midair.
"Heart of the Flame!"
Hikaru bellowed, and her broadsword flared forth from her lens as she plummeted. The blonde girl looked up, gray eyes widening in shock, and barely crossed her two blades before Hikaru slammed into them. The impact nearly bore her over backward, and without slackening his pace, Corwin powered past them like a freight train, his cloak flying about him. The clash of arms behind him faded into a dull background noise as he concentrated all his energies on reaching the arch to the second stairway. Akio and Anthe were already halfway up. He could barely spare the time to hope that the three girls wouldn't get killed, covering his assault. He reached the arch flat out and slammed full force into an invisible barrier stretched across it. Rebounding, he sprawled on his back, somehow managing to retain his grip on stick. Halfway down, he unconsciously tucked into a ball, then kicked his legs up, flipping all the way over and coming up on his feet. The old Valkyrie training coming in handy after all, he thought as he shook the cobwebs out of his head and snarled at the barrier. "Now I know how dogs feel about glass doors," he muttered, wiping blood from his nose in the corner of his mouth. "Son of a bitch! I don't have time for these tricks!" He plunged his free hand into his satchel and came out with a metal ball about the size of a baseball gripped in it. With an angry scowl, he thumbed out the pin, cocked his arm, and threw the ball into the archway. When it struck the barrier, it exploded, rending the archway and sending chunks of stone and mortar scattering in all directions. That obstacle cleared,
Corwin dropped his satchel, dead weight now, and threw himself into a run again, jumping easily over the jagged gap where the grenade had blown out the lowest two steps, and pelting up the staircase as fast as his legs would carry him. Three steps at a time. He skidded around the landing, took the second flight, arms pumping, heart pounding. Akio and Anthy had reached the top step. Corwin, three-quarters of the way up, could see the white-clad figure handing the scarlet-gowned one up onto the platform with a grotesque parody of gallant solicitude.
"Otori!"
he bellowed. The white figure turned, looking curiously down, and Corwin flung himself up, whirling stick into a charging thrust. Umi Ryuzaki was a superb fencer, the finest in her age class in New Avalon, possibly the entire sector, and one of the top 10 across all age groups. She fought in the Hylian Northern Capital style, modified slightly to conform to the rules of standard light blade fencing, and was best with the saber, though she could more than hold her own against all comers with épée or rapier, too. In all her years of fencing, she had only encountered two opponents who seriously challenged her. One was her old instructor, a crony of her grandmother's who had shown her the basics of the Northern Capital style before Grandmama had discovered and put a stop to the lessons. The other was her last year's arch-rival, a former Crescent Heights Middle School member named Clarissa Broadbank, who specialized in rapier and had a tongue to match. The man she was facing now could have defeated Clarissa Broadbank with his eyes closed. Admittedly, he was a kendoka, not a light blade fencer, so there was a stylistic adjustment to be made. Dissimilar style combat was not something often done in tournament, and the only experience Umi had with it was the few mock battles she and the other Magic Knights had engaged in during their travels for lack of anything better to do. He had the same disadvantage to overcome in the opposite direction as far as that went, so it should cancel out. Even so, fighting him, holding her own against him, was taking everything Umi had left. Barely, she got her blade between her body and his strikes, but since that first wild charge, she hadn't been able to launch a single attack. He'd had her on the defensive the whole time, and he wasn't even breaking a sweat. Nall, sensing her energies flagging, decided needling her was probably the best way to buck her up, and piped into her ear, "Boy, Umi, this sure puts that fencing tournament you've been whining about in a whole different light, doesn't it?" Umi's jaw tightened, bringing a little smile to Nall's feline face, and she replied, "It's still important. I just have to survive this first." "Well, do try not to get us killed," said Nall with a nonchalance he entirely didn't feel. "I'm just starting to like you." "Oh, well, that's something to live for." "You can't possibly succeed against Lord Akio." The raspberry-haired girl, Shiori, Akio had called her, informed Fu conversationally as she lunged. Fu's eyes narrowed slightly as she blocked Shiori's attack, feeling the power of the strike jar up her arms and all the way back to her spine. "Smack chat be cheap, honeycake," she replied calmly, crossing up Shiori's next wild swing and pivoting her. "Why do you fight for Mr. Otori? Did you see the way he treated his sister? Don't you think that's shameful?" Wrong thing to say. Her opponent's already blank pupils contracted to almost invisible points, and a look of unspeakable wildness spread across her face.
"Never speak of her!"
Shiori wailed, and threw herself against Fu's guard with a furious energy. Sparks flew from their clashing weapons as she savagely slashed and thrust, searching for a weakness. Wincing, Fu gave ground.
"The Rose Bride must die! Do you understand? She must die so that the world may be reborn."
"Then," said Fu through gritted teeth as she tried to regroup and take the offensive again,
Why are you fighting me? Why not go up there and kill her?
That seemed to give Shiori pause. She slackened the pace of her attack for an instant, her face clearing, a look of immense confusion in her eyes.
Why don't...
she murmured. Then the madness settled in on her again, and she glared at Fu, wide-eyed.
You're just trying to confuse me,
she bawled, surging into the attack again.
I think someone's already done that, Miss Shiori,
Fu observed. She settled into a defensive pattern. There was no hurry, no need to waste her little remaining energy trying to overcome this girl's fury right now. She needed to watch, to think. The primary objective was to keep her from interfering with Corwin, and she wasn't going anywhere right now.
Look, said Hikaru Shido, I don't want to hurt you. Why don't you just give up? I, Nanami Kiryu, give up? For the likes of you? Oh, ho, ho, I don't think so,
replied the blonde. Hikaru cursed inwardly. This girl was better than she looked, and stronger. She handled that heavy sword and dagger combination with an assurance that belied her slenderness. Hikaru was glad her own blade was so stout, and even so, she was having a hard time covering herself against both blades. Several times, she barely slipped a strike in time, taking them against the pommel and guards of the Heart of the Flame as well as the blade. A few she didn't quite evade, and soon her blood was spattering the white stones of the arena from a dozen minor wounds. Part of her problem was that she was holding back her full power. Nanami might be strong, but Hikaru was a great deal stronger, for this girl was merely human, and the Seleucians of Kumbaria are the hardiest breed of that hardy race. Had she really pressed the attack, she could have overpowered Nanami's defenses and destroyed her with relative ease. But, still sickened with the memory of what she and the others had done to Princess Emerald, she recoiled from the thought of giving her all to this battle. The girl even looked a bit like Emerald. Thus distracted, Hikaru fought poorly.
"Why are you doing this?"
she asked, a pleading tone in her voice.
Don't you realize your boss is a total creep? He killed High Priest Sagato. He made us kill Princess Emerald. This world is in chaos because of him. If Corwin can't stop him, he'll enslave all Sephiro.
What do I care? When Lord Akio succeeds, my beloved brother and I will live together in glory and splendor forever. There was a weird tinniness to Nanami's voice, and a strange glazed look in her steel-gray eyes. But she didn't move or talk like a person in a trance, only looked like it. Hikaru would have spent more time being puzzled about it if something the blonde said hadn't caught more of her attention. Hikaru blinked.
Your brother?
Nanami smirked.
My darling Toga, she confirmed,
casting a rather mechanical grin toward the corner of the platform where the red-headed duelist was belaboring Umi.
Once I've gutted you, and he's dealt with your little friend, and Lord Akio has seized control of the pillar, I'm to have him forever. Lord Akio has promised him to me.
Her weirdly blank gray eyes narrowed, and, teeth gritted, she went on,
And I won't let you stand in my way.
Hikaru, who had three elder brothers herself, was too busy being thoroughly disturbed by Nanami's attitude toward her own to give her defense the attention it deserved. The next thrust from that jambia drove through a chink in her armor and straight into the meat of her right shoulder. Crying out, Hikaru grabbed at it with her left hand, wrenching the grip from Nanami's hand, then punched the blonde girl squarely on the mouth, sending her tumbling 15 feet away. Umi's arms were starting to feel like lead, a dull ache rolling up from her hands to pool in her shoulders as she backed further toward the arch to the stairway down, desperately defending herself from her opponent's relentless attack.
She wanted to keep fighting, but she was so tired. This day had gone on forever and ever, it seemed, with the battles on the school campus, and the confrontation with Emerald, and that endless staircase, and now this. She could feel her strength ebbing away. As he sensed her defenses crumbling, the redhead smiled a suave smile. "You're tired," he observed, his voice deep and silky. "Why not give up?"
"Because you'll kill me?"
Umi replied, omitting the trailing "duh" for breath's sake. "Not necessarily," he replied smoothly, all the while relentlessly backing her toward the stairs. "My name is Toga, by the way. Toga Kiryu. What's yours?"
"None of your business," Umi replied.
Now, in addition to exhausted, she was beginning to feel kind of weird. Was this freak hitting on her? In the middle of a life-or-death duel? Sure, he was handsome. Very handsome for a human. But there's such a thing as setting a mood. "Man," Nall murmured in her ear, "this guy must really be hard up."
"Shut up," she snapped at the dragon.
"Come now, don't be that way," Toga said. "I know Lord Akio ordered us to kill you and your friends, but to tell you the truth, I'd really rather not. You have ability, and spirit, and, above all, beauty. You could do worse than to give in to me." He smiled. "I'm sure Lord Akio would let you live if I asked him the favor." He advanced into her guard, their swords locked, and they stood face to face, regarding each other through a gleaming X of steel. Toga's eyes smoldered, the sly little smile on his face seeming to anticipate her surrender. This close to him, Umi could feel his body heat, smell the powerful human scent of him. She felt a jolt of energy rush up her spine, and her head went light. Seeing the light in her eyes flicker, her eyelids droop, Toga smiled a little wider. "How about it?" he murmured, his breath warm against her cheek. "Why not put down that sword? You're exhausted, poor thing. Let me take care of you. There doesn't have to be any more suffering." Nall felt her slacken, teeter on the brink of collapse, and whispered in her ear,
"Except for everyone else's."
Hearing the tiny voice, Umi gasped, her eyes going wide. A surge of shame and anger welled up inside her breast, and with it came enough strength to push him away, renewing the fight. Undaunted, Toga renewed his attack with that same languid energy, as though this, to him, were just another sort of foreplay. Great Triforce, what had she been considering? She knew she was tired, and he was very handsome in a crude sort of human way, but to have actually wasted a moment's thought entertaining the idea of giving in? She felt stained, almost as if she'd actually followed through on the notion, instead of just half-consciously musing over it for a second. There was a foul taste in her mouth. Her cheeks burned. Toga took it for something else, and smiled a little wider as he battered her defenses. "I said you had spirit," he observed playfully, "but this is taking it a little far. I can't wait forever for you to make up your mind. Don't waste yourself needlessly." As angry at herself as anyone else, she replied, "Oh, sure," her jawline hardening as the light came back into her eyes. "Just give up, let my friends die, let Sephiro fall, and spend the rest of my life as your play toy, huh?" "Yeah, what a deal," piped Nall sardonically. Toga's smile widened a little, his eyes twinkling. "It would be a life of pleasure and privilege," he told her, "infinitely preferable to the short and painful existence that awaits if you keep resisting me." Umi's heel slipped over the top of the first step, and she resisted the urge to glance over her shoulder at the staggering drop. "You're almost to the edge, baby," Toga noted. "Make your decision.
Time seemed to stop for a moment with a high, metallic sound, as something inside Umi reached its limit and broke. "Okay," she said. "Fine." With that, she stopped retreating, fixed her grip on her weapon, and straightened her back. Her eyes glittered with fury, her nostrils flared, her ears pinned back, as she shouted ringingly, "Decision made!" Toga's eyes widened with shock at her sudden transformation, and he readjusted his grip and stance too late. Sweeping the heart of the sea behind her in one fist, Umi smashed it against Toga's guard with such force that he was sent skidding back a dozen feet and more. Freed from his constant attacks for the moment, she moved her free hand in an ancient pattern and chanted, "Relentless, pounding sea! Shaper of continents, reservoir of life itself! Heed your master and come forth to engulf my enemy in your timeless wrath!" In a circle of roughly 6 feet's diameter around her, water appeared, rising up out of the stone like rain in reverse, racing around her in a tiny wave. The wave grew, lunged upward, separated itself from the ground, whirling around her in a helix as her long blue hair flew about her shoulders, snapping like a flag in the wind. Then, two glittering scarlet points of light appeared to the right of her face, and a small but surprisingly powerful voice added, "Endless ice, tomb of the world, carver of mountains, shatterer of the strongest stones, heed your master and come forth, to rend my enemy with your ancient fangs!" Umi smiled a cold, furious smile. Her eyes and Nall's both blazed at Toga as she swept her free hand forward, pointing her first two fingers at his heart. "Ice Dragon!" they cried in unison, and the wave surged forward, its leading edge pointing and shifting into the fanged, wrathful face of a serpentine dragon as it came. Toga screamed as the watery apparition hardened, becoming a wicked, glassy assemblage of edges, before it plowed into his chest with a speeding car's force and sent him tumbling back across the stones toward the middle of the platform. Coughing and spluttering, he struggled to his feet, somehow keeping his katana. Something in his chest felt broken, a stabbing, spreading pain. Pink froth rolled from the corner of his mouth as he tried to focus his eyes on his foe. An icicle the size of a dagger jutted from his chest to the right of the join in his tunic, a spreading pink stain around its base. Umi was already coming, streaking toward him like a little blue comet, with her hair flying behind her and the heart of the sea glinting in the sunlight. A defiant, wordless scream poured out of her, and Nall, as she crossed the distance between them, and even as Toga raised his weapon, he knew that he was finished. A second later, he fell face down on the platform in a welter of blood, his blade flying in the opposite direction and tumbling off the edge of the platform. Umi landed not far from the edge, stood panting for a moment as his blood ran down the heart of the sea to coat her hands in sticky heat, and then crumpled to her knees, ribs heaving, so exhausted she was nearly unconscious. On her shoulder, Nall, struggling for breath as well, whispered in her ear, "Not too rotten, Longears. I think maybe I do like you."